This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Last month, President Obama signed into law the Credit Card Accountability, Responsibility, and Disclosure Act. It was designed to curb some of the credit card industry's most controversial, some would say abusive, practices. The bill prohibits companies from raising interest rates on existing balances unless a borrower is at least 60 days late. And it requires 45 days' notice before raising any interest rates. It also increases disclosure requirements and limits the company's ability to market credit cards to young people. But our guest Adam Levitin believes the traditional regulatory approach of banning specific practices and requiring more transparency won't effectively rein in companies determined to squeeze customers for more revenue. We invited him in to explain his ideas for an alternative approach to credit card regulation. Adam Levitin is an associate law professor at Georgetown specializing in bankruptcy and commercial law. He's testified before Congress several times on the credit card industry. Adam Levitin, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, a credit card is, in some sense, a way of transacting a loan. I mean, the bank is loaning you money for a purchase. And in most traditional loans, the lender wants the principal back, and they want some interest, and they make money on that. You told Congress in April that what the credit card companies really do is fundamentally different. In a lot of cases, they're not so interested in getting the principal back.
That's right. There are several different business models that operate within the card industry, but one of them is what Ronald Mann at Columbia Law School has termed the sweatbox model. And a sweatbox credit card lender is not looking to get its principal back. Instead, it wants to keep the consumer paying. And the way it does this is that it will loan money to a consumer beyond the consumer's ability to repay in the short term. And even if the consumer never is able to actually repay that principal, the card issuer will still make a profit because the interest rates and the fees on the balance will be so high that it will offset the loss of the principal. And this is a very different business model than anything we've seen in the credit world before, where we have a lender who's making a loan and really not wanting to get paid back. And that starts to look very predatory. If you wanted to go to a sort of a basic definition of predatory lending, it would be lending where with conscious disregard of consumers' ability to repay. And that's exactly what the sweatbox model is. It's saying, we want to keep you forever and locked in as an annuity, that we want you just paying, and never getting out of debt.
Right. So you're kind of, you get on this treadmill where you're just running and generating fees. And in the end, the principal, I mean, doesn't matter so much. When you spoke to Congress in April, you talked to them about what effective reform would be like. And one of the interesting points you made was that all of this talk about providing more transparency, disclosing information in clear, readable English and bold type, as opposed to these dense statements which are utterly inscrutable, that kind of disclosure really is not going to work. Why?
Well, disclosure has been the primary model for credit card regulation since 1968, since we enacted the Truth in Lending Act. And the idea behind disclosure has always been that if you put the information out there so that consumers can see it and understand it, then consumers will make intelligent, responsible choices, that consumers will know whether to use a credit card and which credit card to use. The problem with disclosure as a model for credit card regulation is that it is not very good at dealing with complex financial products. So disclosure might have been a sensible thing when credit cards first appeared, because credit cards used to be pretty simple. They would have a single interest rate and maybe an annual fee, and that was it. Today, however, that's not what credit cards look like. That credit cards have more price points, different types of fees and interest rates, than any other consumer financial product. It's not even close. And the result is that it makes it very hard to do comparison shopping between credit cards. I can very easily look at two different credit cards and compare their purchase interest rate, but that doesn't tell me what the total cost of revolving a balance on the card will be.
What are some of those other ways that you can get smacked, those other price points?
Well, some of them are explicit price points, the things that are actually disclosed up front, things that there is a cash advance interest rate. Well, you have to know what qualifies as a cash advance. So, for example, you'll often get convenience checks with your credit card statement. those checks are subject to the cash advance interest rate, and there may also be an additional fee. None of those fees are actually disclosed on the convenience checks, incidentally. So you get the check, you say, oh, great, I can use this to pay my rent or my utility bill, put it on my credit card. And you don't realize that, well, it's actually at a much higher rate than if you went to the store and purchased some groceries. There are also things like, you know, over-limit fees, late fees. There are foreign transaction fees now. There are all these very direct-to-consumer fees. Some of them are upfront, like annual fees that you know you have to pay. Others are contingent upon your use of the card, like late fees or over-limit fees. There are also fees like interchange fees that are charged to the merchant, but they get passed through to consumers. And then there are a lot of hidden price points, credit card billing practices that effectively goose up the cost of using a credit card without having to have that disclosed. So, for example, a practice called double cycle billing. That double cycle billing means that the balance on which interest accrues is not the balance solely of this current billing period, but it's the average balance of this billing period and the previous one. So if you had a high balance in the previous billing cycle, that means that you were going to, even if your balance is very low in this current cycle, you're going to be paying interest on a very high notional balance. There are tricks and traps like the time on which a payment is credited. You think my payment was received in the mail by the card issuer on the first of the month when it was due. Well, the card issuer might say, well, your payment was received after 2 p.m., so that's actually the next day. And it's late, therefore you get hit with a late fee, and therefore you're going to pay interest. So credit cards have developed over since the Truth in Lending Act into very complex financial instruments with lots of different explicit price points and lots of hidden ones. The result is that disclosure just doesn't work, that you cannot look at a credit card and know what it will cost to revolve a particular balance.
So a typical way of dealing with an abusive practice is to simply ban specific practices. You can't change interest without a certain amount of notice, or you can't change interest rates on a previous balance. But you told Congress in April that this practice of prohibiting specific abuses also is in the end not going to work. Why not?
There are two problems with it. First of all, you can end up playing a game of regulatory whack-a-mole, where Congress says, okay, card issuers, we don't like bad practices A, B, C, and D. You can't do them anymore. The card industry, though, is incredibly innovative and has a tremendous incentive to innovate around regulation. So if you say you can't do practices A, B, and C, card industry will come up with new practices D, E, and F. And those practices may even be worse than the original practices. So, for example, a couple years ago, consumer groups started making a fuss about a practice called universal cross-default. Namely, you default with a creditor other than the credit card, and that triggers a default on your credit card. So you're late on your cable bill, and all of a sudden, that's a default on your credit card bill.
So I'm late on my cable bill, so the rate on my credit card goes up because that's considered a default?
That's right. So you're being late with one creditor, totally unrelated to your credit card, could lead to higher costs for your credit card, even if you've been paying your credit card on time. Credit card issuers respond to this by dropping universal cross-default and adopting a practice called anytime, any reason term changes. So now it's not that you were late on your cable bill. It's, well, we just felt like it. and now your interest rates are higher. This new practice is broader than universal cross-default. It's actually worse, but card issuers were then able to get up in front of Congress and stand up and say, we don't do a universal cross-default. Of course not. We stopped doing that a year ago.
So if by banning a specific practice, you're simply going to get all of the really smart MBAs and other people in the companies to work with some new innovation that will be just as predatory, what's the solution? How do you change it?
The solution is to flip the regulatory model on its head. Right now, our regulatory model is do whatever you want except for really bad practices A, B, and C as long as you disclose. And what we need to do is flip this upside down and say you can't do anything except for A, B, and C. So what this would mean would be standardized credit cards. That most of the terms on credit cards, consumers don't know what those terms are and they don't care. The only thing that consumers care about with credit cards is the cost. That's what this product is about. We want there to be price competition, not non-price competition in credit cards. And the way we can do that is to require standardization of most credit card terms and let the market compete its heart out on a few essential price points, namely an interest rate, a transaction fee, and an availability fee. And if we said issuers can only have those three price points, and they can charge whatever they want on those three price points, we would get reasonable product differentiation for different types of consumers. So consumers who transact but don't revolve balances, they would want a card with a high interest rate, low transaction fee, low availability fee. And consumers who are planning on revolving balances would want a low interest rate, but they might be willing to have a high availability fee and transaction fee. We get product differentiation, and we would be able to get pretty good price competition. This would start making credit cards a lot more like, you know, the stuff you buy in the grocery store, where you can look at the unit price and have the apples-to-apples comparison.
So you're kind of putting the industry in a way in a straitjacket, saying that, you know, forget all this fancy kind of gizmos that you've come up with. You're going to do a simple product, and it's going to be identifiable and disclosed in simple ways. I mean, that kind of sounds to a lot of people like, you know, socialism. You're kind of squelching the innovative power of markets and capitalism.
Well, that's correct in that it's squelching some innovative power, but let's be clear about innovation. Innovation is not always a good thing. If you have an innovative product, that can be very good. But innovation in the credit card industry has not been product innovation. It's been pricing innovation. It's been innovation in how to structure the same basic credit product so as to make its price less transparent to consumers. That's where all the innovation in the credit card space has been. And that's been negative innovation. We don't want that kind of innovation. We want to channel the innovation so that it benefits consumers, not that it harms them. And the current regulatory system encourages innovation in figuring out how to do end runs around regulation rather than how to make a cheaper, better product.
We're speaking with Adam Levitin. He's a law professor at Georgetown University, where he specializes in bankruptcy and commercial law. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Adam Levitin. He's an associate professor of law at Georgetown University, where he specializes in bankruptcy and commercial law and has testified numerous times before Congress on issues involving the credit card industry. Well, Adam Levitin, the Congress didn't exactly take your advice and adopt the sweeping models of reform that you would like to see. Congress has enacted a law which makes some changes in the credit card industry. What do you like about this law?
The thing that I think I like the most about it is that it imposes sort of a basic requirement of contract law on the credit card industry. For a while, the credit card industry operated as if it wasn't subject to regular contract law. A basic contract law principle is that penalty fees have to be reasonable in light of the actual and anticipated harms. And if you look at credit card late fees and penalty fees, you know, they're just flat $35 fees. You know, you're late for one penny, and it's going to cost you $35. There's no reasonableness there. Alternatively, you could be late 30 days with, you know, $10,000. It's still $35. So this reasonableness requirement, I think, is an important restoration of basic principles of contract law. Another thing that I like about it is that it really prohibits a lot of retroactive term changes. So a problem that currently exists in the card industry, but this legislation takes care of, is that card issuers can not only change your interest rate or the terms of your credit card, but they can change them retroactively and apply them to existing balances. This law limits card issuers' ability to do that. They can only do that in a few narrow circumstances.
What was not accomplished? What concerns you?
Well, there are a few things that it doesn't address. Firstly, it does not address the interchange fees that are charged to merchants. And, well, it has a little provision saying that the government accounting office is supposed to study these fees.
And that's the transaction fee that Home Depot pays when I use my card, right? To the bank, right? Okay.
That's right. And that fee is pretty significant. And interesting that you mentioned Home Depot. Home Depot paid more to credit card companies in these transaction fees than it spent on healthcare last year. I mean, that's pretty astounding. Mm. For a lot of merchants, this is one of the largest and most rapidly growing costs of doing business. And merchants are not seeing any additional value from these fees as they keep going up and up and up. So it doesn't do anything to address that. And that's a problem because these fees actually encourage consumer usage of cards even when it's not efficient. These fees are used to fund rewards programs. It's very explicit, actually, in card issuer accounting that the rewards programs are taken as a deduction from these transaction fees. And the problem is that if I'm using my credit card because I'm a rewards points junkie and I'm desperate to get a few more frequent flyer miles so I can get that first class upgrade, I might use my credit card more than I otherwise would. And law of large numbers says when you have more people using credit cards more often, you're going to have more people falling into the quicksand of interest rates and fees and who are not able to pay off their balances. So merchants are funding rewards programs, but merchants aren't necessarily seeing any benefit. And people who are not paying with credit cards, people who are paying with debit cards, or people paying with cash, or even with food stamps, are seeing higher prices in order to subsidize rewards programs. And that's pretty regressive.
What does the new law do about marketing to college kids, people under 21?
It has some pretty good restrictions there. If you're under 21 and you want to get a credit card now, you're going to have to either have an over 21 cosigner, or you're going to have to be able to show that you have the financial wherewithal to have a card. So card issuers can't start sending out cards willy-nilly to every 19-year-old. They also can't go to campuses and say, hey, you get a free iPod if you open up a credit card. They're banned now from distributing inducements to open up credit cards. And they also cannot start sending out pre-screened offers to under 21-year-olds. In other words, if you're under 21 and you want a credit card, you have to come to the card issuer. They can't come to you.
You know, credit card companies, along with a lot of other companies, have gotten better at mining more of our data, how we actually spend our money on, you know, whether we buy alcohol or shop at Target. What are they doing with that information?
They're doing two things with it. First of all, they're selling it. The data is extremely valuable. And secondly, they're analyzing it. They're mining it to figure out consumer behavior patterns. And another way to put that is they're looking for consumer behavioral weaknesses. One example is that the Federal Trade Commission and Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation brought litigation earlier this year against a company called CompuCredit and some of its business partners for various credit card practices. And one of the things that was alleged in the litigation was that CompuCredit was raising rates on people based on where they shopped. So if they saw that you used your credit card to pay for marriage counseling, or that you used it at a massage parlor, or you got your tires retreaded, they'd say, aha, that indicates something to us about this consumer. That indicates that this is a risky consumer. So we're going to raise rates. And some of that seems kind of reasonable from a card issuer's perspective, that if they see a behavioral pattern, they know why shouldn't they price for it. On the other hand, you can imagine this really starting to interfere with consumer privacy. So imagine you went to the grocery store and the card issuer, currently they don't get SKU level, the actual item level data. They only know the store, but they're trying actually now to get the item level data in the name of fraud prevention. Say they see that you're purchasing condoms or that you're purchasing antidepressants or something like that. Maybe they say, well, that says something about this type of consumer, and therefore we're going to raise rates. And that's just not something consumers bargain for. That, first of all, most consumers have no idea that what they choose to buy is going to determine the cost of credit for them. And even if they did, I think very few consumers would be comfortable with that. That, you know, as the deal with the credit card company has always been, you charge me an interest rate for my risk, and if I pay and I pay off my balance, and you don't worry about what I'm buying, that's none of your business. Your business is simply make a line of credit available to me. And we're seeing that card issuers' use of behavioral data is really starting to bump up against consumer privacy concerns.
You know, the credit card companies have warned that now that they are restricted in their activities in the industry, and particularly on the fees and charges they can impose on those who are behind on their balances. They say those of us who pay our cards off every month are going to get dinged. There's going to be a higher cost for people with good credit. What about that?
There may be some of that. I think what we're going to see is we're seeing, first of all, a lot of flux in the industry regardless of this legislation. So even before the legislation passed, we had card issuers cutting back on credit limits and raising rates, even on good creditworthy cardholders. So it's going to be hard to just say, you know, it's the legislation's fault. This was happening already. Secondly, we are going to see a reshuffling of the way credit card price structures work. We're going to start to see lots of new fees and just product features. So my best guess is we're going to see something like a high-risk transaction fee. So if you maybe that's, you know, you make a purchase over the internet, that there's an additional charge or something like that. They're going to come up with a bunch of new fees. They're going to start charging fees for things like getting a paper statement. We're probably going to see interest rates go up, but that doesn't mean that the cost has actually gone up. And that's a nice trick the card industry likes to play, is to say, oh, look, interest rates are higher. This legislation has caused the cost of cards to go up. That's not the case. My best guess is that cost of credit cards is going to remain basically stable, and that we're just going to see card issuers manage to restructure the cost of cards around the legislation. We're going to see some non-credit-worthy consumers have a tougher time getting credit, and that may not be a bad thing, that some of these so-called fee harvester cards, where to get a $300 line of credit, you have to pay $150 in fees, those are going to be substantially restricted. And that's probably a very good thing. You know, maybe it's a little paternalistic, but we've seen the problems that unregulated markets can wreak on society with the mortgage market.
Well, Adam Levitin, we're out of time. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Adam Levitin is an associate professor of law at Georgetown University, specializing in bankruptcy and commercial law. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.